Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For the past 5 years, the Iowa Artist Fellowship Program, run by the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, has been recognizing 5 Iowa artists each year. The artists get access to professional development opportunities and a small grant to invest in their work, and we get to enjoy their work. This hour, we'll meet 3 of this year's fellows, but first, Veronica O'Hearn is an artist herself. She's also Grant Services and Artist Programs Manager at the Iowa Arts Council, and she's with me on the line. Hello, Veronica.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go back in time to over 5 years ago. What was the genesis for this fellowship program?
The Iowa Artist Fellowship Program started really when the Iowa Arts Council took a look at all of our funding and programs and realized, you know, the purpose of the Iowa Arts Council is to support arts and culture in Iowa. And artists are really the foundation of that. And we needed a better way to give them tools and resources to allow them to advance their own work and really elevate their careers in Iowa.
So often we focus on the end product, on public art, things like that. Do you feel like sometimes nurturing artists, the idea of investing in the future of artists, gets lost in the shuffle?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, and you'll especially see it in the programs that are available through colleges and things like that. You're constantly kind of working on theory and the concept of your work, but artists are really never given just the kind of basic business tools to make a living at what they do and really decide, you know, what their goals are going to be for themselves as an artist. And so the Iowa Artist Fellowship Program really kind of seeks to help them determine what those goals are and what the steps are to achieve them.
Well, yeah, let's talk about what the artists get out of this experience. There's an application process, and so they have to apply to be part of this. It's a very competitive application process. What does an artist receive if they're chosen?
So they receive from the Iowa Arts Council professional development, and that comes through a partnership that we have with Creative Capital, which is a nationally recognized professional development program out of New York. They come and spend a weekend with the artists and train them in things like marketing your work, how to write grants for your work, business planning and strategic planning. And then we also, throughout the year, will give them promotional assistance. So we will highlight their work on our statewide platforms, you know, social media through our blogs, and then our marketing team will work with their contacts across the across the state to try to just bring more recognition to the work that they're doing. And then we also have a Meet the Artist program where we take the 5 fellows kind of out on the road and we go to different communities across the state and give them the opportunity to present about their work, introduce their work to new audiences, but then also the opportunity for those communities to tell the artists a little bit more about them. So it's a really great way for them to kind of develop partnerships across the state. And then finally, as you mentioned earlier, they do receive a grant that they can then apply to either their work directly or to more professional services to continue to advance their careers.
Right, and that's a $10,000 grant. It started out when the program started as a $5,000 grant, and now it's a $10,000 grant, which maybe that sounds like a lot to some people. I have a feeling that can go pretty fast. It's a little boost to an artist.
Yeah, you'd actually be surprised how quickly that does go. You know, they have the same types of expenses that anyone has, and often they're working other jobs as well. So finding time and space to make their work and to focus on their work is often what a lot of them use that money for. But really, when you're considering rent and materials and supplies, it just doesn't go that far. But we'd like to kind of think of it as a little boost for them to kind of refocus what they're doing and make sure that they know that their time is valuable and that there's funding that can be applied toward it.
The artists that are chosen for this program tend to be mid-career, established artists or established in whatever field they're making their living at. Why focus on artists at this point in their lives as opposed to young emerging artists or something like that?
Because we really want to focus on artists who know what they're doing, know that making work is something that's important to them, whether they choose to do it as a full-time career or, you know, alongside another profession. And then also the resources that we provide them, both with the grant and the professional development, really require that they're making a concerted effort to elevate what they're doing, you know, that they're taking themselves seriously as artists. And sometimes when you're fresh out of college, you might not know for sure that that's something that you want to pursue, even though you've just received your degree in it. And then often with sort of end of career artists, they're kind of wrapping up what they've done and looking at retrospectives and things like that. So we're really focusing on artists who are actively working in the state and engaging with the public, people who will continue to have an impact on Iowans with their work.
Who decides who the fellows will be?
That's a great question. We use a citizen panel. So each year we select three individuals who come from a variety of different backgrounds. Some of them are directors of nonprofits, cultural institutions, board members for the Iowa Arts Council, and they do remain anonymous during the review process, but each year they do change, and so we do get a panel's input on who they'd like to see as the fellows each year.
Well, in this hour, we're going to meet some of the fellows. As I mentioned, there are five, and we only have time to talk to three of the fellows this hour. So let's talk a little bit about the other two, because there's such a variety of different kinds of art represented among the five fellows. Let's talk a little bit about Lauren Haldeman. She is an illustrator and poet who lives in Iowa City. She's been on this program in the past, but just tell me a little bit about her and why she's one of the fellows.
Yeah, so Lauren was selected as one of the fellows. She's a very strong poet, as you mentioned, from Iowa City. And what really struck the panel with her work is it deals very much with vulnerability and joy and grief. And she's really looking to engage people through poetry on a very human level. And part of the way she's seeking to do this in the coming years is beginning to pair that poetry with visuals. So things like film and drawing and illustration, because she's really trying to use her words to connect with others and help them heal through their life journeys, whether it be through grief, through happy moments. She often focuses on motherhood and the death of her brother. And so she's really looking to connect with other people, and in doing so wants to sort of expand how poetry can be understood through visuals. And that's what she's going to be focusing on this coming year through what she calls hybrid work, which will be a series of poetry comics as well as a graphic novel to kind of, I think she believes that sometimes poetry can be a barrier to connecting with people just because as an art form, sometimes it's a little bit less understood. And so she's really seeking to kind of bring that to more people by combining it with visuals.
Let's talk also a little bit about Molly Wood. She is a photographer and she focuses her work mostly on botanicals. Tell me about her.
Yeah, so Molly is a photographer and she primarily takes still life images of botanicals that were traditionally used by women in history for culinary and medicinal purposes. She sees botanicals as a metaphor for life cycles and as well as the duality of human experience, as she puts it, kind of the way that life can both be healing and toxic at the same time. And Molly's work this coming year, she's really focused on expanding the audience for her art, just in the sense that she can engage, you know, the gardening community, people focused on botanicals and farming, as well as people familiar with women's role in history. And so she's really seeking to do that through new exhibits and getting her work to wider audiences as well.
Now, we're talking sort of midway through the year for these fellows. When does the fellowship end?
So it's based on the state fiscal year. So their official term will come to an end on June 30th, but they'll retain their designation as fellows in perpetuity.
And that also means that you have another application cycle that's coming right up, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we are gearing up for that. Our next deadline for the coming year, which will then begin on July 1st to June 30th of 2020, will be March 15th.
All right. And I mentioned it's a very competitive application process. About how many applications do you receive every year?
We receive anywhere from about 50 to 70 applications each year, and that may or may not sound like a lot to some people, but they are typically, you know, very high quality. So we do have a really wonderful pool of artists working in Iowa, and so we'd love to see those numbers only increase in the coming years as more people become more familiar with the program.
Well, and I can imagine that people, probably some people, apply year after year. I mean, just because you don't get selected one year doesn't mean that you might not be a candidate the next year, right?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And as you mentioned, we only select five each year to make it sort of a very intensive program focusing on the five artists. So we absolutely encourage people to apply from year to year. Some of our current fellows this year have done that. You know, they've applied multiple times, and this year was just their year to be selected. So we absolutely encourage repeat applicants. And just knowing also that the panel changes, the kind of opinion of the people who are reading through these applications and selecting artists will change as well.
This program has been going for 5 years now. Do you have a vision for the future? Would you like to expand it?
We'd love to expand it, always. Part of what we're also working on now is focusing on the alumni network of artists. So as of this year, it's our fifth year, so we have 25 artists who have gone through the program. And part of what we're looking at doing now is sort of strengthening the network for those 25 artists and focusing on kind of bringing them back together year after year as well, just to make sure that the network of artists stays strong in Iowa. While we selected the artists and kind of bring them together to start with, I think one of the newest parts of the program has been the relationships that develop between the artists themselves.
Well, Veronica, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Veronica O'Hearn is Grant Services and Artist Programs Manager at the Iowa Arts Council. She is the manager of the Iowa Artist Fellowship Program. We're talking about that this hour. She is also an artist in her own right. We'll meet some of the fellows throughout the rest of the hour. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Iowa Artist Fellowship Program run by the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. And now we're going to meet a few of this year's fellows. First up is Noah Doley. He works in photography, sculpture, and video. He's an assistant professor of photography at the University of Northern Iowa, and he is with me now. Hello, Noah.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you. And what attracted you to this program? What made you want to apply to be a fellow?
I mean, there's a number of different reasons. You know, the first of which would be that, you know, it can be very difficult to find the funds to make work, and to have that support was extremely beneficial. And so, you know, I always have more projects that I want to do than I have the funds to be able to support those projects.
I think so, every artist feels that way.
I think, yeah, it'd be strange if you didn't. And so that's part of it, obviously. You know, having that financial support, being able to do some things without having to worry about the cost of them. And then also, you know, Veronica and everyone at Iowa Arts Council has done a really great job of helping to connect artists to each other and to the community of Iowa. And so, you know, through the fellowship program, I've been able to meet all these artists who I might not have otherwise crossed paths with, and, you know, connect with people. Iowa, the Iowa arts in Iowa can sometimes feel quite fragmented. And so this is one of the ways that we sort of connect to one another.
And really build a community. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your work, because in saying that you work in photography, sculpture, and video, that says almost nothing.
Right.
So let's talk about your most recent project so people mm-hmm. can get an idea of the kind of work you do, although your work is pretty diverse, so I mm-hmm. don't know that this gives us that idea. But tell
yeah.
me about your latest project.
Yeah, I'm always kind of struggling to find a way to kind of define, you know, what I do sort of broadly. And, you know, and I kind of like that it's sort of hard to do that. I think if it wasn't a bit of a struggle, I'd become less interested in it. But I kind of work from project to project, and some of the projects that I do are very self-contained. Like I'll do one that just takes, you know, I'll do over the course of a few months and then it's done. And then I have other ones that I'm working on at the same time that I'm working on other ones. And so a lot of the work I do is photographic, but most of the time that I'm working, I'm not walking around taking pictures. I'm doing things like building sculptures and building sets and things like that. And so the project that I'm currently kind of most focused on is this series of cyanotype photographs. And the cyanotype photograph is a 19th century photographic process that produces these images that are this very distinctive shade of blue. And it's kind of this, I don't know, I thought it was kind of a fascinating historical curiosity, the fact that this photographic process has this color. And I'm always thinking about the way that photography translates reality in different ways. And so I started to think about the way that this process kind of translates reality in this very distinctive kind of way. And just thinking about how when you see something in this distinctive shade of blue, how does that alter your subjective experience? What kinds of assumptions might you make about what you're looking at? Versus what's actually being depicted.
And you seem to be very intrigued by historical photography. Mm-hmm. You did another project using pinhole cameras, yep. which yep. I think a lot of us learned about when we're learning about eclipses.
Growing up.
But I mean, you've done a whole project where you really built they were terrariums, but it looks mm-hmm. like an underground cave system, and took photos yep. through the pinhole photography. I'm curious, what has this fellowship allowed you to do this year that you wouldn't have been able to do otherwise?
A lot of it has been just being able to, I guess, maybe get to things a lot quicker than I get to them a lot quicker than I normally would be able to. And so
you
like,
can have an idea and make it happen instead of
yeah,
sitting on
basically.
It.
Yeah. And a lot of the times, like, it's just a matter of kind of waiting until I have enough money to purchase something. A lot of my money, honestly, goes into framing. A lot of people don't know, you know, how much money actually just goes into framing. So I had an exhibition at the University of Northern Iowa a few months ago, and I was able to just purchase a bunch of these frames for those works. And so And right now I'm trying to finish this cyanotype series, or at least get it to a state of completion where I can start exhibiting it. And I'm purchasing frames right now for that. But I'm always, you know, it's kind of hard for me to define like what exactly this money is going towards, because I'm always doing all these different things in parallel. I spend a lot of time on eBay collecting objects to use as props or things in photos and stuff like that. And so the money is kind of is helping me, you know, make purchases that I otherwise might, you know, pause and maybe put projects on the back burner.
Do you feel like this fellowship makes Iowa a more inviting place for artists, for people who might otherwise think about leaving?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a substantial it helps substantially, and you know, not only the money, but it's, you know, it symbolically it kind of communicates, you know, to me and to all the other artists and the people of Iowa that, you know, that we're supported and that this is something that the state takes seriously.
Is that something that you talk with your students about at UNI? I'm sure that there are students with a lot of hopes and dreams, but also thinking maybe this isn't the place I can make that happen.
Yeah, that's something we definitely talk about is, you know, it's the difficulties of being an artist and making work after school. And, you know, there are places that you can seek out funds. It's not always easy. You know, I'm one of those people who applied, you know, multiple times for the fellowship. You know, it takes some work to do it, but if you stick to it, you can get help.
Well, Noah, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Noah Doley works in photography, sculpture, and video. He is an assistant professor of photography at the University of Northern Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're talking about the Iowa Artist Fellowship Program created by the Iowa Arts Council, and we're meeting some of the 2018-2019 fellows. Mary Jones is up next. She is a mixed media artist who makes unique maps inspired by her exploration of a place, most recently, the east side of Des Moines. She's also a retired professor of art and design. Hello, Mary.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I think my description of what you do doesn't really get anywhere close to doing it justice. So let's dig in and talk about what you do. First, you choose a place to explore by taking long walks. What are you looking for? What are you doing when you do that?
I'm looking for what might not be immediately obvious. I've done walking projects for years now, and what I've found is that what I notice is a great cacophony of human effort. It seems as though, particularly in neighborhoods, people do all kinds of things to make a place feel like home, to make it feel like they belong there. And I also see how things have changed over the passage of time and how things are patched and repaired and maybe tried to disguise and maybe not.
So when you're walking through an area, do you have an idea of what you're looking for when you go there, or do you try to open yourself up to surprises?
Oh, I really try to be open for surprises, because one of the wonderful things about walking is that despite the regularity of footfalls and breathing, I find that my mind just sort of goes wild and might land on anything. And anything that I see is going to give rise to a memory or even something unrelated. So I think that's part of the joy of walking is just what it does to the mind.
How do you record what you see?
I actually don't. Sometimes I stop. In fact, my walks are usually long enough that I like to stop someplace where I can sit and write for a little while or draw. Along the way, I do take some photos, but I don't try to plan them too much in advance. I guess what I collect is a function of memory, too, because by the time I do collect it, it's from memory.
You also look for found objects that you encounter that you might be able to incorporate into your work. So what kinds of things might you pick up?
There are all kinds of amazing bits of detritus, things that kind of get left on the sidewalk. Sometimes I do, if they're available, I will pick up newspapers or things like that that are available and really have something to do with the neighborhood where I am. But a lot of what I pick up is actually discarded.
Once you have gone on one of these walks, then you've maybe taken pictures, you maybe have written some things down and made some drawings, you may have a bag of trash to take home with you.
That too.
What happens next?
Well, then I take it into the studio and lay it out and just consider how things relate, just where the relationships form visually and also thematically. Sometimes something can arise that I hadn't really considered, but I see it once it's all laid out in the studio.
Mary, when we talk about maps, the artwork that you create doesn't really look like the kind of map that probably pops into most of our minds. So can you describe what your maps look like for me?
Well, they're layered, and they include photos and words, my handwriting, and some drawings that I've done, and also some things I found on the street, some discarded papers and things like that. So really, they aren't geographically accurate at all, but they're a pretty accurate measure of how my thoughts have jumped around and how the walking has given rise to thought.
When somebody looks at one of your maps, what do you want them to take away from the experience?
I guess I want them to realize that experience of place really does have a lot of layers to it, and that it brings about memories, and that really all kinds of things can form attachments to a place. It can be aspects of the built environment or the natural environment, and that our focus keeps shifting.
When somebody explores a place through your maps, what kinds of feelings do you want them to have? What are you trying to evoke in them?
It makes me really happy to be looking at a map with someone and to hear them laugh. And it's usually just an aha. It's a little piece of recognition. Perhaps they've been there, or maybe even they sense the texture of confusion.
I want to talk about this fellowship program. When you were selected to participate in the Iowa Artist Fellowship Program, how did you respond?
Well, I was thrilled, first off. And it was also some validation, because I felt like the projects I had been working on up to that point were addressing some larger questions. The whole notion of place and why people feel like they belong in a particular place, I think is a question that affects everybody and really has some potential for creating more of a spirit of community.
Coming up in February, you're doing a mapping workshop in Ames. It's called Topophilia, and it's part of a festival of personal geography taking place at Design on Main. Are you helping people make their own personal maps?
Yes, and it is a sort of an experiment that I've tried with other people. What we're going to do is identify markers of belonging. You know, the question I pose to people is, what is it that really makes you feel as though this place is home? And it can be a feature of the built environment or the natural environment. It can also be a smell or even a sound. And so then we're going to map those things out on an actual map of Ames, because I feel like it's a really valuable experience to see how those markers connect. And I think that they tell a story. In fact, I think that when I've asked people to do this in the past, they start telling me their story based on these little things that have been important to them over time.
What has this fellowship allowed you to do that you might not have been able to do otherwise?
Well, for one, it's allowed me to work on a much larger scale, and it's allowed me to experiment, too. In the past, I've been so cautious about, oh, can I really afford to do this? And also, now I feel as though I've got a support system. I've got not only the other fellows, but other people that I've met that I can bounce ideas off of, and they'll help me out. We really, the fellows as a group, we really help each other out with some honest criticism and suggestions.
Mary Jones, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mary Jones is a mixed media artist. She makes unique maps after long walking tours, and she lives in Indianola. She is one of the Iowa Artist Fellows for this year. Coming up in just a moment, we'll meet another one of the fellows, Julia Franklin. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Iowa Artist Fellowship Program, created by the Iowa Arts Council back in 2014 to support professional working artists in Iowa. I've also been talking with some of the 2018-2019 fellows, and the final artist we're going to meet today is Julia Franklin. She is an installation artist, telling stories from the objects that people leave behind. In the past year, she's created her most personal installation. It's called Picking Up the Pieces. In it, she recreates parts of her childhood home and displays objects that once belonged to her father, who took his own life when she was 16 years old. The exhibit was recently at Simpson College, and it opens next Monday at Graceland University in Lamoni and will be on display at the Helene Center Galleries through March 1st of 2019. And Julia is on the line with me now. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for talking with us today. And for people who aren't familiar with this term, what does it mean to be an installation artist?
So an installation artist is someone who alters and changes a space so that when you walk in it, you don't longer think that you're in a gallery or in a museum. And so it's almost like a set for a stage or for the movies or for a TV show.
Do you remember when you first encountered that kind of art?
I never really encountered a lot of those pieces. There's the artist Edward Keenholz and his wife Nancy, who always went to junk stores and got things out of the dumpster. But I've never really gotten to personally experience something like that myself.
So where did the idea of doing it yourself come from?
When I was in graduate school and even in undergrad, the idea of using found objects was not really appreciated because when you use a found object, you're using something that exists and something that has a history and a power and a background all of its own, but it's not something that I've made. And so it's kind of frowned upon that artists should be making things. And I really see art as something where the artist gets to select things, that we're choosing what is important and what is valuable and what we need to talk about and what should be seen. And so I finally had the courage, once I got my own art teaching position, to kind of try those things, to really intentionally use found objects and then create displays for them. And a display on the wall has moved and transformed into a display in a whole space, in a whole room or four rooms for this upcoming show.
Well, let's talk about, before we dig into this installation, let's talk about maybe pick one of the ones you've done in the past and describe it for us.
Well, a couple of years ago, actually now it's been about 12 years ago, I did a show called Landscapes, and that was really where the first room transformation happened. And my daughter was 4 years old at the time in 2006, and a four-year-old is a fascinating person, and she taught me to start looking at the world around me. And she and I would go on walks every day, and we might only get 25 feet down the sidewalk, and she would have me pick up things and put them in my pockets to hold on to them because they were so precious and interesting to her. So it could have been a stick or a rock or an interesting seed pod. And so when we started going on these walks, I started taking a wagon and glass jars, and we started filling up those jars with the things she found interesting. And so that's where it was kind of born out of, was that experience with her. And so in the gallery, I ended up carpeting an 800-foot gallery in turf with real grass. So even she helped me roll it out. We would go in the evenings and spray water and mist the grass so it would keep growing. We even had to mow it with an old lawnmower. And it was a really cool experience because it was my time with her and her seeing the world and finding it fascinating.
Let's talk about this installation, the picking up the pieces. And you have said that you feel like all of your previous work was preparing you for this installation. How is that?
Well, I've been working with found objects for about 20 years now, and the majority of the objects were things that I would find on walks because sometimes they were discarded or lost by other people who had been on that same path. So I was always using other people's objects, and it had other people's stories and histories attached. And it was really with picking up the pieces, the show about my father and his death when I was young, where I didn't actually have any of his things. And it took my mom passing away 3 years ago for me to start to get a few files. So I got some documents that shed a little bit more light on the situation. But most importantly, I had a cousin who came forward about 2.5 years ago who brought me a box of my father's belongings. And I didn't know anything of his still existed in the world. And so it was a box of ties and handkerchiefs, cufflinks, even letters he wrote my grandparents during the Korean War. And I really got to see him as someone not my father, someone who was this really three-dimensional person now and who had a life before me and what maybe shaped him. So it was just pure luck that my cousin had his things and stored them for decades and then was courageous enough to bring them to me, to share them with me, to see if I wanted to know more about where it came from.
Yeah. And your father took his own life when you were 16 years old. So you only knew him from a child's perspective in many ways before.
I did, and that was it. It was one of those things that was so out of the blue because he was the person I adored most in the world, and I know he adored me and my sister most in the world. And so for us, it was completely out of the blue and unexpected, and it was something that my sister and I never understood. We couldn't understand why he might have made that choice. And at the time, we were told it was because we were in debt. And it turns out there were so many more things compounding on him and putting pressure on him. And I'm not really sure he had another choice when I look at all that's emerged within the last 2 years of that.
So at this point, you feel like you understand why he made that decision?
I feel like I have a better understanding. I think what was important and what I don't think my cousin understood when she gave me those things is that it was evidence. And one thing led to another. It led me contacting other relatives and friends to ask about what was really going on. And they had known all along, and they just kept it secret, because they didn't want to hurt us, and they didn't want to change the memories we had of our father, because he was fantastic. He was our nurturer. He did our laundry. He took us to school. He picked us up. We had such a deep relationship with him. But there were things in his past that they didn't want to share, that they didn't think was his responsibility or their responsibility to share with us. So it took us being in our mid-40s before people felt that they could share that with us.
Do you feel comfortable sharing what you learned about him with us?
Well, sure. It was something I picked up on when I was reading letters that he wrote during the Korean War. He was stationed outside New York City, and he was actually stationed with a family friend, and I didn't realize that family friend was someone he had known for decades. And it turns out they had been roommates before. My mom and him, my dad, got married, and they actually lived a couple blocks away. So I didn't understand this friendship was so long-lasting, but it's also very suggestive that they were a little bit more than friends. And that was the first first thing we uncovered is that my dad was gay and that he was mostly in the closet. But it seems that everyone knew he was gay, except for my sister and me. And so that's something that people have started talking about. But it's something where they just knew, and they accepted that, but no one really had conversations with him about that. But he was still married, and he had two little girls, and so he kind of kept that lifestyle. And I think you can definitely see where he's torn about maybe leading a false life. So that was one of the first things we uncovered. The second thing we uncovered was that he was to be a key witness in a murder trial. And I happened to stumble upon it by chance, because in this box of things of my father's, there was a box from my grandmother who had passed away in 2000. And it was a box of letters for only my sister and me to read. And they'd been sealed in envelopes for 17 years. And in those letters, my grandmother, my dad's mom, she wrote him on the anniversary of his birthday and his death every year for the next 10 years. And in it, she's always asking, why did you do it? Why? I don't understand. This doesn't make sense. And in letter 13, she says, was it something pertaining to your plumber? And that triggered a memory for me. My dad was an accountant, and I remembered he had a client, a plumber, who had been poisoned with arsenic. So I Googled it. And I happened to find out a little bit more about this and what happened, and there was a book written about it. So I downloaded it, and in that book, I found 4 pages about my dad. I found newspaper articles directly quoted in there about my dad, and I didn't realize that even the sheriff at the time thought my dad had been murdered and that he didn't commit suicide, or that perhaps he had been blackmailed and that his death was all connected to this murder that I had no idea of, really, until a couple of years ago.
Among these belongings, you also got your hands on or came into possession of the note that your dad left behind, right?
Yes, and that was what was really odd. When my mom passed away, she had been living in a nursing home, so she had very few possessions left. And in his briefcase, it was kept in her dresser, and it had important documents in it, like her will and medical power of attorney and things like that. We actually found a file with his original suicide note. And that happened 3 years ago today, actually,
wow.
That discovery of that note. And we were surprised she kept it. And it was something my sister and I had only read to us. And that was something that stayed with us. We only remembered the first line of the letter. And the first line is, I have failed miserably as a husband and father. We didn't remember the next lines that were, I hope you have it in your hearts to forgive me. And we didn't remember any more of that letter, but just that first line where we felt guilt for decades, maybe that we contributed somehow to his death. But it turns out all of this new evidence for us has been a way for us to make peace with that past, because it means we weren't contributing to his death at all. We were, in fact, really great kids and something he should be proud of, but it was all these other factors, all these pressure points that really led him to that. So for us, it's allowed us to forgive ourselves for the guilt that we carried on that.
So you've been going through this incredible journey of rediscovering your father, getting to know him as a person, not just your dad, because of all of these objects. What made you decide to turn this into art?
Well, I think I use art to process the world around me and the things that we find valuable. And I've always used found objects in my work. But when a box of my dad's belongings landed in my lap, I knew I had to do something with it. And so all the pieces that I've been working on, it's still me playing with ideas, playing with information, trying to make sense of it, and really trying to come to terms with it. And so art is the language I know best. And so it does a good job of trying to communicate things that sometimes I can't put into words.
So you have recreated parts of your childhood home using your dad's belongings, but what else have you been able to pull into this? Do you still have objects that were important to you as a child?
Well, miraculously, in those few files that my mom left behind, there was also a file folder of my own drawings that I did as a kid. So there's a couple scribbles from when I was in preschool and a couple drawings in kindergarten, first grade. And some of them are images of my family. So, you know, a little kid, happy kid, drawing family, drawing what Halloween looks like. And so I think that was really cool. So I have my old artwork, original artwork, that's also in the show as part of the setting to kind of add to that personal quality. I have a few trinkets here and there, things that I've saved of my mom's or that were from my childhood. I saved my dolls and had those in a bucket, a container in the basement for years. So all those things kind of came out in pieces that I started putting together to create this whole experience.
When people visit this installation, and you've also written a play that will be read coming up here in February. But when people experience this installation that you've put together, what do you want them to take away from it?
One, I hope they start to see that art can be more than just a piece hanging on the wall or a sculpture on a pedestal. The furniture, in a way, becomes the pedestal for some sculptures that are made, that are created. But it's a way to look at a life, to get in someone's shoes and see the world from their perspective in a whole new way. We have TVs and movies that help us do that and books. But art, this will be a full interactive experience. You can open drawers. You can see all of those things that were there that I was oblivious to as a teenager, as a kid. But I think you'll also take away a little bit better understanding of what maybe the dynamics were like in our house and maybe memories. I think there's some really good things that you come away with. I think there's some things that are sad and tragic, but I think there's also a sense of hope that if you've gone through something traumatic, something that changed and disrupted your life forever, that you can survive it and you can overcome it and you can learn to tell that story, that narrative in a new way.
Are you hoping that people, in looking at your life, in this snapshot of your life and your father's life, that they'll be able to look at their own lives in a new way, too?
I'm hoping so. I think there's a lot of things that are very nostalgic. It's a way for them to start a conversation because it helps them remember and connect back to memories, to places and people and things and events. And I think art becomes that bridge and helps us have those conversations. And the show does deal with suicide. It does deal with loss. And we tend to not talk about those things. They're still so taboo. And if my art can kind of start those conversations, help people share their experience, maybe do a little grieving, but have someone to do that with, I think it will be very helpful. Because we need to talk a little bit more to one another. We need to know what that secret thing is inside of us that we're ashamed of and realize we all have those things and that we can talk about it and that we have a lot in common.
Julia Franklin, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Charity.
Artist Julia Franklin, she is an installation artist, and she's also one of the fellows with the Iowa Artist Fellowship Program of the Iowa Arts Council this year. Her installation, Picking Up the Pieces, will be on display starting on Monday at Graceland University in Lamoni through March 1st. And it does deal with the story of her father, who took his own life when she was 16 years old. And I want to take a moment to mention that if you or someone you love is in crisis, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number is 800-273-8255. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.